What we're going to do today is continue the series that started a while back, where we're going to go basically through each of the books of the Bible and do a rough outline of it so that we understand what's where in our Bible. The book of Leviticus is where we're at. That book is a continuation of Exodus, the book of Exodus that we have looked at before. It was written about the same time. If you take a look at the very end of Leviticus, Leviticus 27, and look at verse 34, Leviticus 27, and in verse 34, I'll get my Bible to flip that. Page one to stick today. It says, "These are the commandments which the Lord commanded Moses for the sons of Israel at Mount Sinai." These are the commands that God gave to Moses while they were still at Mount Sinai. Actually, Exodus ends with them beginning to leave. So this book actually backs up just a little bit. These are a continuation of the commands that God gave at Mount Sinai, where Exodus basically tells the story of Israel becoming a nation and the building of the tabernacle at the end of Exodus. Leviticus deals with the detailed instructions for carrying out the laws, particularly those things that were needed to be done by the priests. That's where the name Leviticus comes from. It actually literally means that pertaining to the Levites. Again, it's based on the Septuagint name of the book. Most of the Hebrew way of naming the books is they take the first couple words out of the whatever book it is, the first couple words, that's the name of the book. And so a lot of times it doesn't give you much of a description of what the book is about. When they did the Septuagint version, at least they picked names that had something to do with what the book was about. This was a book for the Levites, and that's because the Levites, that's were the tribe from which the priests, particularly the descendants of Aaron, descended from. Take a look back at Exodus 28. You know, we're going to, just to show this, Exodus 28, and in verse 41, it says, "You shall put them on your, and you shall put them on Aaron your brother, and on his sons with him, and you shall anoint them, and ordain them, and consecrate them, that they may serve me as priests." Aaron and his sons, and then from that point on, all his descendants were to be priests of God. And they were of the tribe of Levi. The other Levites then serve as helpers for the priests. Now we're going to go to the book of Numbers on the other side, because it actually has the details of this event. Numbers chapter 3, starting with verse 6. Numbers chapter 3, verse 6 says, "Bring the tribe of Levi near and set them before for Aaron the priest, that they may serve him. And they shall perform the duties for him, for the whole congregation, before the tent of meeting, and to do service of the tabernacle. They shall also keep the furnishing of the tent of meeting, along with the duties of the sons of Israel, to do the service of the tabernacle. You shall thus give the Levites to Aaron and to his sons, and they are wholly given to him from among the sons of Israel. So you shall appoint Aaron and his sons, that they may keep their priesthood, but the laymen who come near shall be put to death." And he goes on and describes the various things that they were to do. The reason for that is actually, as he goes on and describes this, is Levi had stayed before the children, stood with Moses when most of the children of Israel had begun sinning. They had gone off into idolatry, had started committing all sorts of sins. Levi was the tribe that stood with Moses. And because of that, it says in verse 11, "And again the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Now behold, I've taken the Levites from among the sons of Israel, instead of every firstborn, the first issue of the womb from the sons of Israel, so the Levites shall be mine. For all the firstborn are mine. On the day that I struck down the firstborn in the land of Egypt, I sanctified to myself all the firstborn in Israel, from man to beast. They shall be mine. I am the Lord." So basically what God has said is that originally when he took them out of the land of Egypt, the last plague that he gave to the Egyptians was the death of the firstborn. Because he spared those who obeyed his commands, God said, okay, these firstborn will be mine. And all firstborn thereafter, to remember this event. But when the Levites stood up with Moses, in fact, that took place in Exodus 32. Let's read that just real briefly. Exodus 32 and verse 26. It says, then Moses stood at the gate of the camp and said, whoever is for the Lord, come to me. And all the sons of Levi gathered together to him. And he said to them, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, every man of you put on his sword upon his thigh and go forth, back and forth from the gate to the gate in the camp and kill every man his brother and every man his friend, every man his neighbor. And so the sons of Levi did as Moses instructed, and about 3,000 men of the people fell that day. Then Moses said, dedicate yourselves today to the Lord, for every man has been against his son and against his brother, in order that he may bestow a blessing upon you today. They had rebelled. The punishment was death. Moses called for anyone who would stand with him. The tribe of Levi was basically the only one to withstand. And they were given orders, basically, to kill whoever they ran across as punishment for that sin that they had committed. And because of that, God said, okay, instead of keeping the firstborn, I'm going to allow you to redeem them back. You get to buy those firstborn back, but the tribe of Levi is going to be my servants from now on. Aaron and his sons particularly were going to be the priests. The rest of the tribe of Levi would be his helpers. And the book of Leviticus is basically the instructions to the tribe of Levi. Here are the duties which you are to perform and carry out. And the book is actually a series of laws on a variety of topics. Probably most prominent is the laws of sacrifice. What was to be done, when they were to be done, how they were to be done. But there's also laws covering social interactions. There's laws covering health. There are a variety of laws that are given in Leviticus. And because of that, that's also probably why most people don't sit down and just read Leviticus. Because after a while, you get just one law after another law after another law, and you start... And yes, it's a hard book to get through. But there are two, by the way, historical accounts in the book. There are two sections in there. One's in Leviticus 8, and it goes actually all the way to chapter 10, verse 10, which gives a history of the basically consecrating of the first priests. And what happened right after that, everybody remembers Nadab and Abihu, and they're giving of the strange fire. That was a part of, it happened right after they were consecrated as priests. They get consecrated as priests, and then they turn around and offer God the wrong thing. Here they got the instructions, they turn around and immediately start going the wrong way. And so that's one historical account. The other one's in Leviticus 24. 10 through 24 is another brief history, again, of discussing where Israel had gone off this into sin and where someone from the tribe of Levi, again, does something to rectify that. Well, let's talk about the organization of the book just a little bit. In Leviticus 1 through 7, so chapters 1 through 7 are all these laws about sacrifices. So we have all the laws concerning offerings. In there. And then it's broken down. Basically, each chapter becomes one of the offerings. The first offering is the burnt offering. And that's in chapter 1. A burnt offering was something that was voluntarily given. There was no specification of what had to be given. You could give anything you basically wanted, but it was fully dedicated to God. You gave up all possession of it, and if it was something that could be offered to God, it was burnt. I mean, it was wholly given to God. you lost all possession of. Now, there are, a lot of people get mixed up and they see burnt offering and they think, well, everything got burnt. Well, the answer is no, because it's like, for instance, somebody decided to give a pig. Pigs were considered unclean animals. Those were not burnt on the altar. It would be taken as a burnt offering. It was given up, but it was then used for something else. You can even give houses. There's laws dealing with that too. But that need to understand that, because that does come up later in the book of Judges, where some, a person is given as a burnt offering. And what it basically means, she was solely, totally given over to God. No, she was not burnt on the altar, because that would have been profaning God's sacrifice. But it was something that was given totally to God. In chapter 2 is an offering that's called the meal offering. And in that meal offering, it's basically an offering of thanks. These are the times when usually it was done after a sin offering or something else where they get gain forgiveness of sin. And to show thankfulness to God, there was an offering that was given that was called the meal offering. In chapter 3 is another offering. It's kind of related. It's called the peace offering. The peace offering was an offering to show that you were in fellowship with God. So once it was to say thank you to God, one was to sit down and say, hey, we are in fellowship with one another. We are in fellowship with God. In chapter 4 is an offering that's called the sin offering. That offering was given for forgiveness of sins in general. So when you had like basically a group, or you just want a generic, hey, I've been living a sinful life, I need God's forgiveness, there was this offering that was called the sin offering. Contrast to that, there's another one that's in chapter 5, which is called the trespass. In chapter 5. Of course, I misspelled it. But the trespass offering in chapter 5 is for a particular sin. So if there was one particular sin that you've been guilty of and you wanted God's forgiveness of, before that particular sin, there was a trespass offering. And then if you go through chapter 6 and 7, it's almost as if they go back through all the offerings again. They do. But they give additional instruction for each one. So it goes back, reviews the offerings, and then gives additional instructions as well. Then chapters 8 through 10 dealt with the laws dealing with consecrating priests. When someone was made a priest, how do you do that? How do you set that person aside and say that he's devoted to God? This one's done as we mentioned, a historical text. We have Aaron and his sons being consecrated. In chapter 8, then in chapter 9, Aaron offers sacrifices now that he's been consecrated. He offers sacrifices for himself and then also for the people. And then what we have, everybody remembers, is Nadab and Abihu's problem. Their rebellion, in a sense, because basically their carelessness. They were just not careful about following what God said. In fact, there's implications in there. They had gotten drunk just beforehand, which has led to their carelessness. And so we have the consequences. So basically we have, here's how to become a priest. Here's what the priest is supposed to do when he becomes a priest. Hey, you better be careful. This is serious business. It's basically what those take care of. I'm going to write one more. Yeah, I'm running out of room here. I'm going to put it down here. Hopefully everybody can see that. We have the laws of purity. This covers from chapters 11 to 15. These are all those laws of uncleanness, what's clean, what's unclean. Chapters 11 deals with food and objects. So what food constitutes clean and unclean food? What happens if you touch something that's unclean? There are some things that were considered unclean. So that's all that's in there. Chapter 12 is solely about the birth of babies and how to handle that and the laws for that. Chapters 13 and 14 has to do with skin diseases. In particular, the disease of leprosy was mentioned in the class today. Leprosy is a disease that where your skin literally rots and you lose all feeling, which is amazing. If they made him, it says there was a general in the army. A leper doesn't have feeling in his skin. So one of the problems is they oftentimes cut themselves or hurt themselves and they have no idea because they don't have any nerve endings left, which makes being a general very difficult because they got sharp things all around them all the time. But it deals with skin diseases. And then Leviticus 15 deals with other discharges from the body. So oozing wounds, menstrual cycle, the blood flow, things like that. Anything that comes from the body, how to handle those items. So they're basically health laws. Then going on to chapter 16, there is the laws covering atonement. This is there was one day, a feast day that was called the Feast of Atonement. And there is a whole chapter devoted just for what sacrifices were to be done, how it was to be handled, how people's sins were to be atoned for that year. And all the laws were done in chapter 16. Then there were laws from chapters 17 to 20. There were laws that says how to be a holy people. The Israelites were supposed to be special people set apart to God. And so there were laws saying this is things that you're going to have to do because you're special people. So in chapter 17 is all the laws about blood. There's life in the blood. You're not to eat blood. What do you do when you butcher an animal so that you don't pollute yourselves with it? Chapter 18 are all the laws dealing basically with sex. Who you can marry, who you could not marry. And other laws like that. When sex was allowed, when it was not allowed. Then 19 are just basically various applications of the law. And by that what I mean is, okay, we have, for instance, laws saying that stealing was wrong. How do you apply that? How do you do judgments on those? So it goes basically through most of the Ten Commandments and starts saying, okay, here's what you have to do. Here's what you do when somebody breaks the Sabbath. Here's what you do when somebody doesn't honor their father and mother. So those are all those laws. And chapter 20 basically continues that with all the penalties. So this is the applications of it. These are all the penalties for breaking the law. Then from chapters 21 to 22, right? Yeah, 22. I got a miss. These are all the laws for the priests. So it covers their, you know, what duties they have to do, how do you change the table of showbread, how do you keep the lamp lit, you know, when do you burn the incense, all those type of laws for how to just conduct worship. In fact, in starting with 23 to 25, those are all the laws, especially about worship. So they have, for instance, starting with chapter 23, are all the holy days. It's in chapter 23. And by that, I'm not going to write them all down, but it covers, for instance, the holy days the Israelites had, is they had a Sabbath. Every day of the every 7 days, the last day of the week, the seventh day, was a Sabbath day. It was a weekly worship day. It was on that day they were not allowed to do any work because it was called a Sabbath day. And it was for a remembrance that they were once slaves, now free. This was a law there to basically a day set aside every day of the week, 1 day a week, to remember that they were once forced to work. And they celebrated it by not working because they were no longer forced to work. And so this was become their remembrance of where they came from. Another one was a Passover, which we're getting close to that season. It was done in the springtime. It was to remember that God spared the firstborn, and by passing over them and Israel's departure from Egypt and slavery. Then there was a Feast of the Unleavened Bread. It also was the week which the Passover took place in. And that was basically to remember that they were purified by God. And in that week, they were required to take all the leavening out of their house. So anything that was made with leaven. So no raised bread. And one that a lot of people don't realize is you couldn't actually even have alcoholic drinks because that's fermented and with yeast. That's out of the house. So all this stuff's out of the house during that week, and then the Passover was taking place during that week. That Feast of the Unleavened Bread is one of the feasts where all males were required to come to Jerusalem for. There are three holidays, and this was one of them. Then there was a Feast of the First Fruits. That was to give thanks to God for his blessings, because God said all the firstborn, including all the firstborn animals, all the first of the crop, that belongs to God. So that was the time when they gave the first of their crops. Pentecost came 50 days after the Passover, or actually the week of the Unleavened Bread. And Pentecost, again, was another holiday for thankfulness. It was a feast to celebrate the harvest. The first fruits was basically the beginning of the harvest. Pentecost was roughly the end of the harvest. And it was a time and this was another one where everybody had to come. So there was one for Passover, there was one for the Pentecost. Everybody had to come for that one. Then jumping all the way into basically September time frame, they had a feast that was called Trumpets. This was a call to the people to become aware of the fact that they were sinners. It was followed shortly thereafter by the feast that was called the Day of Atonement, when they actually gave a sacrifice to atone for their sins. And that's to remember the fact that they were sinners and that they needed God's forgiveness. Then it was followed by another feast that was called the Feast of the Tabernacles. Interesting, the Day of Atonement, everybody was not required to be there. Feast of the Tabernacles, everybody was required to come again. And that was to remember the wilderness wanderings, which we haven't got to yet. But this was another feast that they had, and it again was required by all the males. And then every 7 years they had another holiday, which was called the Sabbath year. And that basic holiday that year was they had to leave their fields unplowed. They can gather whatever happened that came up by natural means. And so if they, you know, the grapevines and stuff like that, they, whatever happened to grow that year, they could gather that, whatever happened to spring up just from leftovers from the prior years, they could gather that, but they couldn't cultivate the land that year. They had to let it rest. And basically that was a year for them to learn to depend on God. The unfortunate thing is the Israelites never did got to the point where they actually did that. And when they got to the captivity, God says, I'm going to make it 1 year for every year that you skipped on the for the Sabbath years. And that's the reason why there were 70 years in captivity. He said, the land's going to get this rest one way or the other. I'm going to make it rest. Since you kept skipping it, you got 70 years worth accumulated over time. So basically for 490 years, they hadn't been doing it. Then every 50th year was called a Jubilee year. And on that year, all slaves, all Israelite slaves were freed. All land that was sold went back to the original family. So basically when you bought land, you didn't buy land permanently, you rented it on a 50-year cycle. But everything goes back to the original tribe and back to the original owners. All slaves were freed, and it was called the Year of Jubilee. And again, to remember the fact that it was a time of restoration and a time of freedom, and the fact that they had came out of Egypt and God had freed them. And that's all covered in that chapter. In chapter 24, it's actually two things are covered. In 24, there was daily worship. So things that had to be done on a daily basis, and that's the first part of chapter 24. And then the second part of 24, there were laws for the judges. In particular, what's emphasized is the fact that there had to be fair. They had to be non-biased. They had to make sure that the laws were carried out. They couldn't compromise on those laws. They couldn't, you know, say, well, I feel sorry for this person, so I'm going to lessen it or something like that. There was very much an emphasis saying it had to be fair and it had to be even-handed. Then on the 25, chapter 25, that was the Sabbath year laws and the Jubilee laws. That we'd already just mentioned. And we only got two more chapters left. 26 is basically the promises or blessings and the consequences. Basically what God says, okay, if you follow these laws, here's the things I'm going to do for you. If you break these laws, here's the things I'm going to do for you. And so this is all laid out in that chapter. And then the very last chapter deals with vows and when you consecrate something to God. What do you do? And that's basically that chapter there deals with, for instance, what do you do when somebody decides to give as a burnt offering of a house? You can't burn a house. But it could, but then it becomes worthless. Or what happens when somebody dedicates a land to God, consecrates a piece of land to God? How do you handle that? Where does it go? Who gets it? Who possesses it? And all that other stuff. So all those things are covered in the book. So there's a big rough outline of Leviticus. As Christians, we look through it and say, okay, yeah, there are a lot of interesting laws. And we can see what God liked and didn't like. But there's things also we need to understand. For instance, that passage that we read in Hebrews chapter 10. We'd like you to go back there. We have that as our scripture reading today. There's things that we need as Christians, even though we're not under these laws of sacrifices, and we don't participate in them. Notice in verse 8, Hebrews 10, verse 8, it says, "And after saying above, sacrifices and offerings and whole burnt offerings and sacrifices for sins thou dost not desire, thou hast not taken pleasure in them, which are offered according to the law." What are those? Now, it sounds like he's repeating himself. What are you talking about? Whole burnt offerings, sacrifices, offerings, trespass offerings, sin offerings. He's talking about these different types of offerings and the purposes they had. And God was saying he wasn't pleased with them. And so we need to understand that. For instance, the Bible talks about the fact that Jesus was our sacrifice. That's one of the points that is made in Hebrews chapter 10. In verse 10, it says, "By this we have been sanctified through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ, once for all." Well, in Ephesians chapter 5, Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 2, it says, "Walk in love just as Christ also loved you and gave himself up for us, an offering and a sacrifice to God as a fragrant aroma." That phrase, a fragrant aroma, is a reference to the burnt offerings. Jesus was a burnt offering. Why was that? Burnt offerings were voluntary. There was no requirement of what got given. And so Jesus was our burnt offering because he did it voluntarily. And there was also no requirement what was given. He gave himself as a sacrifice. Well, a burnt offering is given wholly to God and there's no taking it back. What does that tell us about Jesus? Jesus gave himself completely to God's will. Or take a look at 2 Corinthians. 2 Corinthians chapter 5. And in verse 21. It says, "He made himself who knew no sin to be sin on our behalf, that we might become the righteousness of God in him." It's a reference to the atonement sacrifice. Because you had to take something that was unblemished. You took a goat. And the goat stood in for the people of Israel. And one goat was sacrificed. And the other was released. And that became the atonement sacrifice. And it's referring to Jesus, who had no sin himself, took on our sins. Just like the scapegoat took on, it was symbolically taking on the sins of Israel and then was sacrificed. And so if you understand those sacrifices and what the purposes are, do we need to know that you have to wave it in certain directions and so many times and all that other stuff? Probably not. But we do need to understand what those sacrifices were for and why they were there. So that when we read references in the New Testament say, hey, these, you know, Jesus being our atonement sacrifice, oh, that's what they're talking about. Or even for us as Christians. Take a look at Romans chapter 12. In verse 1, it says, "I urge you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship." What's he talking about? What kind of sacrifice is he referring to? He's talking about a burnt offering. We give ourselves wholly over to God and serve him. In fact, if you look at the rules about when people are dedicated to God, consecrated, that they serve God all the time. That was basically one of the rules. If somebody, you know, gave a servant, that was a person, they didn't get burnt, they became servants of the temple. And he's referring to Christians, we are servants of God. We are wholly dedicated to him. Or in Philippians chapter 2, and in verse 17, So, but even if I'm being poured out as a drink offering upon the sacrifice and service of your faith, I rejoice and share my joy with you all. And there you would have to read about the meal offering that was given and realize that one of the parts of that meal offering was the pouring of the drink offering on top of it. He says, your sacrifices are the meal offering. I'm the drink that's being poured on top of it. And he's basically saying that he's thankful to God. Because that's what the meal offering was about. Or take a look at 1 Corinthians chapter 10. 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and in verse 16. It says, is not the cup of blessing which we bless a sharing of the blood of Christ? Is not the bread which we break a sharing of the body of Christ? Since there is one bread, we who are many are one body, we all partake of that one bread. When we partake of the Lord's Supper, it is a form of a peace offering. It shows that we are in fellowship, both with one another and with God. Or the consecration of the priest. The high priest served as a mediator between God and man. Well, Jesus is our mediator. 1 Timothy chapter 2. 1 Timothy chapter 2 and in verse 5 says, for there is one God and one mediator also between God and man, the man Jesus Christ. Where in the Old Testament, every time somebody died, they had to get a new mediator, a new high priest. We have just one. He's there for all times. He is our permanent high priest. And that's what's mentioned in Hebrews chapter 4. Hebrews 4 and verse 14. Hebrews chapter 4 verse 14 says, since then we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. Jesus is our high priest. In fact, Hebrews chapter 8 and verse 10 through 10 describe how Jesus functions as our high priest, as well as being our sacrifice for us. Or the laws that we went through a while back, talking about the laws of uncleanness. That's a representation of sin for us. Unclean in the sense was not sin itself, but it was a type of sin. It represented what sin was about and how it spreads and how do you contain it and how you have to purify yourself. It helps us understand. All these things are in Leviticus, but yeah, in one way you can look at it as just a boring set of laws. But it's important for us to understand because it's a basis of, when in the New Testament, when it says this is how we offer praise to God. This is how we offer sacrifice. It was the reality that was shadowed for us in the Old Testament. And when we see how they did it then, we can see what God expects of us today. Just a brief survey of Leviticus. Hope it was useful to you. Tonight we're going to go into a study about law, but in a totally different form. Basically talk about why we have two laws. Why, what did God say we have to have an Old Testament and a New Testament? Why did he change it? So that's what we're going to tackle tonight. So I hope you'll be able to come back for that lesson. Right now, though, we'd like to offer an opportunity. If there's anyone here today who is not a child of God, we didn't get into the details about the Christian law and how to become a child of God, but if there's anyone who wishes to become one, there is no better time than the time you have right now, because we're not guaranteed the future. And if there's anyone here who is a child of God and would like the prayers of their brethren on behalf, why don't you come forward with me and sing the song of the Sabbath.